For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
The U.S. city of Charlotte, North Carolina, late Thursday, a third night of protest against the Charlotte Police Department's handling of the controversial police shooting of an African-American man earlier in the week. VOA's Isha Sarai was out among the protesters.
We've marched over with them from Mayor Bearden Park to Trade and Tryon, which is kind of the center of Charlotte City. It's a pretty historic place where most of the protests have been going on the past couple of days. We've seen a lot of riot police. They're being dispersed, but no signs of tear gas or rubber bullets yet. The streets are pretty full right now. So far, nothing's turned violent.
A young protester who was shot a day earlier died on Thursday. 26-year-old Justin Carr had been struck by a bullet as he stood outside a hotel in that neighborhood where the disorders took place, and police said they did not fire the fatal shot. Police contend that 43-year-old Keith Scott, who was shot by police on Tuesday, was holding a gun when they shot him. His family said Scott was unarmed and that he may have been simply carrying a book that he was reading. Police said they found the gun but could not find a book on the scene. America's top military officer, General Joseph Dunford, says that Russia bears ultimate responsibility for an airstrike on a U.N. humanitarian convoy in Syria. Dunford told lawmakers on Thursday that two Russian aircraft were in the area at the time the convoy was attacked. He also said he does not favor sharing military intelligence with Moscow in the Syrian conflict. This is VOA News. Al-Shabaab militants say they have attacked a police station in the northeast of Kenya near the border with Somalia. Local residents told VOA's Somali service on condition of anonymity the militants fought with the police for more than 30 minutes using machine guns and rocket-propelled grenades. Al-Shabaab has vowed to continue attacks across the border in retaliation for Kenya's military operations in southern Somalia. Kenya sent troops to Somalia in 2011 to help the African Union combat Al-Shabaab. Afghanistan's unity government, after months of difficult negotiations, has signed a long-delayed draft peace agreement with the country's second-largest insurgent group, led by a fugitive warlord with a history of war crimes and rights abuses. The groundbreaking truce signed with Hizb Islami, the faction, comes amid reports and hopes that it might ease security challenges that are facing Afghanistan and encourage other insurgent groups fighting alongside the Taliban to join the peace process. This is the first peace agreement in the 15-year Afghan war the Taliban launched after it was ousted by a United States-led military coalition in 2001. Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras says his country was no longer in a survival mode after years of financial distress. He spoke to the United Nations General Assembly.
Since I spoke here last year, Greece has faced this great crisis standing force. Today, our discussion is no more about surviving crisis. Today we focus on how, on the basis of political and financial stability, we can work towards economic growth, more effective and humane migration management, as well as peace and security in our broader neighborhood.
Prime Minister Tsipras said the refugee crisis is more than 60,000 migrants still stranded in Greece, and the Coast Guard continues to rescue thousands of people. President Obama awarded this year's National Medals in Arts and Humanities at the White House.
Today the focus is on our recipients. And today's recipients of the National Medals of the Arts and the Humanities are poets, musicians, artists, journalists, professors, historians, and at least one chef.
And that chef is Jose Andres. Among the recipients are comedian Mel Brooks, composer Philip Glass, Broadway actress-singer Audra McDonald, trumpeter Wynton Marsalis, that is, and poet Luis Gluck.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Boateng in Washington. Today is Friday, September 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, current chair of ECOWAS, says the sub-region is committed to fighting terrorism.
ECOWAS has demonstrated its commitment and preparedness to combat terrorism in Mali, Cote d'Ivoire, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, and other parts of the sub-region.
Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speaking Thursday at the UN General Assembly. Nigeria's military denies use of disproportionate force in its fight against Boko Haram militants. Can dialogue defuse tensions in the Democratic Republic of Congo? Meanwhile, analysts say the DRC crisis impacts the Great Lakes region.
If the DRC makes it through this historic transition that is so deeply desired by the Congolese people, that is something that could have very positive reverberations in terms of economic investment and human capital across the region.
Thomas Perillo is the U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region of Africa. A Nigerian uses roller skating to unite youths in the streets, and researchers say they are closer to developing a vaccine against the Zika virus. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, current chairperson of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, says the regional group is committed and prepared to combating terrorism in the sub-region. Speaking Thursday at the ongoing 71st session of the UN General Assembly, Sirleaf said ECOWAS is also consolidating peace and security in the region by emphasizing its fight against organized crime.
The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has demonstrated its commitment and preparedness to combat terrorism in Mali, Cote d'Ivoire, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, and other parts of the sub-region with valued support from partners in the international community. The ECOWAS initiative to bring peace to Guinea-Bissau, the African Union efforts in Mali, South Sudan, and the Great Lake Chad Basin that is combating Boko Haram and other terrorist groups show progress and demonstrate clearly the relevance of regional solidarity. With a view to strengthening peace and security within ECOWAS, we have emphasized the fight against organized crime, illicit cross-border trade in illicit small arms and light weapons, drug and human trafficking and piracy.
President Sirleaf said Liberia stands ready to assume its own security responsibility after the United Nations mission in Liberia, also known as UNMIL, ended its mandate at the end of June this year.
Since our conflict ended in 2003, the United Nations mission in Liberia, UNMIL, has worked with Liberia first to institute and then to consolidate security, peace-building efforts, and governance gained in the country. I am pleased to report that a drawdown plan of UNMIL was successfully executed on 30th June 2016 when Liberian security agencies assumed from UNMIL full responsibility for the security of our nation and our people. We recognize the risks involved, given the severe state of our fragility and a scarcity of resources, but we stand tall to assume these responsibilities, knowing that partners are still with us.
Sirleaf, who is nearing the end of her second and final term in office, said her government remains committed to addressing extreme poverty as well as empowering women and girls. She also said Liberia's democracy remains strong as the country prepares for presidential and legislative elections next year.
As a resilient and determined nation, which has faced the challenges of several periods of devastation, Liberia is rising again, determined to walk the decided road to the achievement of our 2030 vision and to successfully conclude the first 5-year phase of our agenda for transformation. Our democracy, stalled by many years of conflict, stands firm as we march toward its strongest task, the conduct of presidential and legislative elections in the year 2017.
That was Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speaking Thursday at the ongoing 71st session of the UN General Assembly in New York. Nigeria's Human Rights Commission has accused the military of using disproportionate force in Zaria in the country's north, where at least 380 Shiite Muslims were killed in 2015. In a report released Thursday in the capital, Abuja, the human rights organization said the victims were members of the Islamic Movement of Nigeria sect. But the army has disputed the commission's account that the confrontation left about 380 sect members dead. Brigadier General Rabi Abubakar, Nigeria's Director of Defense Information, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the accusations are unfair and regrettable.
The human rights in Nigeria have formed, I can call it an opinion, that whatever we do, they always accuse us of human rights and that. But it's unfortunate that they could come up with this kind of thing. I could remember last time the Miss Miller allegations against the Nigerian Armed Forces, which eventually, you know, it turns to be false. And this one, too, I believe it will equally be false because the Armed Forces is responsible for ensuring peaceful coexistence, ensuring, you know, stability of the country. So whatever we do, you understand, is for the best interest of this country. So what I am saying, in essence, is we are constitutionally empowered to ensure total peace and security in our country, you know. So whatever actions that could have been exhibited by the force, I believe is something which should be commended, not to be condemned.
Will the Nigerian military cooperate with an independent investigation into this alleged murder of 300 members of Shiite Muslims?
No, we don't have such report in our possession. You understand? So what I'm saying is, We have been cooperating with, you know, an independent and responsible organization that come to this country to assist us in moving forward. You understand, not an organization that's based here who has formed an opinion, negative opinion for that matter, against our post. No nation can tolerate anybody to wake up and paint its own national post negativity. We cannot take it.
The accusation sometimes is that soldiers or the military tend to use disproportionate force against the civilian, even during the course of fighting against Boko Haram militants. What is your response to such criticisms that sometimes the military flouts the rules of engagement as it fights armed groups, including Boko Haram militants?
We are 100% mindful of that, and that's why we are always you know, we have what we call rule of engagements, you know, on operational procedures. And these are the issues, or these are the guidelines that guide us in the conduct of our operations at whatever level you can think of, either it's a tactical, operational, or strategic level. We always have this guidance. We have the rule of engagement, and we have the operational procedures. So in an operation that such as what we are doing now in Nurses, we cannot 100% rule out the possibility for minor, you know, incident. But that could not in any way be made to form an opinion about us. We are always willing to ensure that we get rid of our nations of any form of vulgarism, militancy, and terrorism. And I believe the world at large appreciate what we are doing and are seeing all the efforts we are contributing to ensure that there is free of terrorism and militancy and any other vulgarism. And that's why we are even contributing to the United Nations despite our internal crisis here.
Will the Nigerian military institute a mechanism where soldiers are properly trained to respect the rights of Nigerian citizens in their fight against armed groups, Boko Haram and all?
As I'm speaking with you, that's one of our cardinal principles of the new leadership of the armed forces now. We have established human rights death in all our operations and in all our missions in the Nigerian armed forces. So this would give anybody a clue that, yes, Nigerian armed forces of yesterday is not the Nigerian armed forces of today.
Brigadier General Rabi Abubakar is the Director of Defense Information of Nigeria. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 23rd. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send a shout out to listeners on Radio Life in Lofa County, Liberia, Rush FM in Bamenda, Cameroon, and Brela FM in Lagos, Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. President Joseph Kabila of the Democratic Republic of Congo has blamed the opposition for this week's deadly protests and again endorsed dialogue, but has the violence further complicated the path to a negotiated solution? The UN human rights chief has slammed what he called the government's extremely confrontational response to protesters, saying at least 50 people were killed this week. William Klaus has the latest on the talks from Kinshasa.
With a written statement read out by a presenter on state media, President Joseph Kabila gave his response to this week's deadly unrest. He condemned the organizers of Monday's march, a large opposition group known as Le Rassemblement, or the Assembly, saying that they had diverted their supposedly peaceful demonstration towards, in his words, blind violence or worse, bloody riots. And once more, Kabila urged all of the DRC's political parties to join the dialogue in order to find a peaceful path to elections. That dialogue started earlier this month with help from the African Union, but the talks have struggled for credibility. Le Rassemblement rejected them as a trap designed to maintain Kabila in power beyond the end of his second term in December, and instead called for Monday's demonstrations to demand that the president step down. A smaller opposition coalition did join in the dialogue, but the talks were suspended this week amid the violence. They are due to restart on Friday. Juvenal Manubu, an opposition parliamentarian and a delegate at the talks, spoke to VOA.
Il y a une frange de l'opposition qui refuse toujours d'y participer.
Manubu noted that instead of participating in the dialogue, Le Rassemblement called for protests, which resulted in deaths and repression on the streets of Kinshasa. He urged them to reconsider and join the dialogue. I believe the door to dialogue remains open. The door is always open, he said. But the prospect for a negotiated solution took another hit on Tuesday. The body representing the Catholic Church, known as CENCO, suspended its participation in solidarity with those killed this week. CENCO condemned what it called the security forces' heavy-handed response to protesters. Hans Horbeck is a senior Congo analyst at the International Crisis Group.
The Catholic Church and the CENCO are organizations that have at least a larger level of legitimacy than any of the political and social actors in Congo. Since the start of 2016, they have tried to build more inclusive platform around the need for a dialogue. And to have some degree of legitimacy, any agreement coming from the current dialogue has to include the signature of the CENCO. Without that, I wouldn't even say that a lot of the other social and probably also political organizations are not going to sign it.
CENCO says even if it does return to the dialogue, it will not put its name to any agreement which does not include an explicit commitment from the president not to stand in the next election, because a third term is forbidden by the Congolese constitution. Polls were supposed to be held in November, but now aren't expected before 2018, as the Electoral Commission says it needs time to compile a new voter list. William Klaus for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The president of the Democratic Republic of Congo is about to enter an unusual political limbo as his term officially expires in December, but elections are nowhere in sight. As VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg, deadly protests this week over the delay have raised fears that the DRC might become yet another chaotic, violent political crisis country.
The date December 19th hangs over President Joseph Kabila's head, over the nation he has ruled for 15 years, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and over Central Africa. That should be the last day of his second and final term in office, according to the DRC Constitution. But the nation's Electoral Commission says it will not be able to hold elections until late 2018. Kabila has not said publicly what he will do. His critics say he has been stalling to stay in power. Some of his supporters have called for a referendum to remove term limits. Elsewhere in the region, leaders' attempts to extend their grip on power have led to violence in nations that are already fragile and underdeveloped and can ill afford the accompanying economic shocks. International Crisis Group Central Africa Project Director Richard Moncrief says the DRC has been torn apart by civil conflict in the past, and that this crisis is about more than just leadership.
The constitution of 2006, for them, is how they got out of the civil war. So it's not just a constitution. It embodies a peace agreement and it embodies the desire of the Congolese to live peacefully together. So when we see the president trying to undo that constitution for his own narrow ends, it's fairly natural and understandable that people are very upset and angry about that.
Rights groups say the DRC government has acted to suppress dissent, imprisoning activists and violently putting down protests. The DRC government spokesman defended security forces' response to demonstrators this week, telling VOA that some of the protesters came just to loot and destroy and kill. Central Africa analyst Stephanie Walters of the Institute for Security Studies says what happens in the DRC inevitably reverberates.
Because Congo is so big and because it has often drawn in other countries around it into its wars, and other neighboring countries have chosen to get involved in wars in the DRC, you know, greater instability and the lack of credibility of a government in Kinshasa is very bad news for the region as well.
Walters has criticized the African Union for being relatively absent from the debate and has called for the continental body to reiterate its stance against changing constitutions to extend presidential term limits. Instead, the bloc has set up a continuing national dialogue that much of the opposition has boycotted. The United Nations has called for the nation's ruling party to build bridges with the opposition. U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region, Thomas Perriello, says the DRC's neighbors need to push for a resolution through dialogue.
This is an excellent time for regional leadership. Leaders in the region, of course, have such depth of knowledge of the country, but also have such a direct stake in the impacts of the situation in DRC. If the DRC makes it through this historic transition that is so deeply desired by the Congolese people, that is something that could have very positive reverberations in terms of economic investment and human capital across the region.
Thursday, South Africa's president expressed concern about the violence in the DRC and called on all parties to participate in the AU dialogue. But in his statement, Jacob Zuma did not mention Kabila once by name or allude to his next step. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Inspired by a Hollywood movie, one Nigerian is bringing roller skating to the streets of his hometown. His goal is to unite young people in an impoverished neighborhood. Eliasu Kasimu has the story from Jaws, as narrated by Salim Solomon.
His name is Bashir Sel Mohammed Dankumbo, but he goes by Basi, or size 2, and he's using roller skating to unite young people in the streets of Jos, an impoverished city in Nigeria's middle belt.
I started skating in 1990. Actually, that's when I created my own rollerblades from scratch. At that time, I experimented using scrap metals, which I tested out in the neighborhood. People used to wonder, what is that? I first saw rollerblades in a Jackie Chan movie, Winners and Sinners, and I thought to myself, if he can do it, so can I.
His goal is to bring youth together from different backgrounds to bridge their differences through skating.
I was able to bring together youth from different neighborhoods, religious and tribal backgrounds. We have developed a bond of love and understanding between us where we come together often to practice in the stadium.
But his talent isn't just roller skating. He is also an artist with a passion for painting.
I'm also a creative artist. I can draw and paint. In the beginning, my mother thought I was crazy.
Since his first grade, he would always run out of pencils before any of his siblings. He would always lay on his tummy, drawing and tracing all kinds of figures and shapes that filled up his notebooks fast.
Bashir is one of many young men in Jos and other parts of Nigeria who refuse to let unemployment or economic hardship prevent them from living a fulfilling life. In 2010, Jos was the scene of violent clashes that often pitted Christians against Muslims. Bashir sees roller skating as a positive outlet for young people to channel their energy.
I have encountered many challenges along the way. A lot of people used to ridicule me as a disillusioned, jobless person, or sarcastically hail me as an action hero boy.
Bashir hopes to share his talent with more young men so they can steer away from taking negative paths. Salim Solomon for Ilyasuk Asu, VOA News.
Every year, $7 trillion is spent on global health care, but there are still millions of people who need treatment and cannot get it. So, 6 years ago, Chase Adam, now 29, decided to start a radically transparent international crowdfunding healthcare website. His vision to make the world a healthier place by streamlining contributions made Chase Adam the San Francisco Chronicle newspaper's Visionary of the Year. Jan Sluiser looks at the website that sparked that honor.
It was one of those life-altering experiences that happened by chance. Peace Corps volunteer Chase Adam, traveling through Costa Rica by bus, stopped in Watsi, where a woman got on, soliciting donations to pay for her son's health care. Adam had seen people do that before, and they rarely got money. But this woman did, and he wondered why.
And then I found out that she had her son's medical record with her. It was in a red folder, and she was passing it around the bus. And that really resulted in her earning the trust of all these local passengers. So I remember making a donation, and she got off the bus. And then a few minutes later, just thinking, you know, why isn't there a website for this? Why isn't there a website that makes it really easy for people like this woman to raise money for healthcare that they can't afford?
So when his Peace Corps service ended in 2011, Adam set one up, following the model of crowdfunding websites like Kiva that gives money directly to entrepreneurs to start businesses. Watsi funds medical care.
From a donor or user's perspective, you'd go on the website and see photos and stories of patients who need health care but can't afford it. And you can donate as little as $5 and directly fund the costs of their life-changing medical procedures.
Watsi works with a global network of well-respected nonprofit medical organizations, which identify patients in financial need, help them upload their information to the website, and provide the medical care once it's funded. Adam says the criteria for receiving medical help are simple.
The procedures have to cost less than $1,500 US, and they have to significantly improve the patient's standard of living. So these are life-changing or life-saving procedures.
Procedures like cataract surgery, heart operations, cancer treatments, club foot repair, setting bone fractures, and healing burns. So far, Watsi has raised some $7 million for patient care.
Approximately 20,000 donors on our website have contributed to approximately 9,000 patients in 23 countries.
One of those patients is Tibisigwa, a widow and mother from Kenya. For the past 12 years, she had been living with debilitating uterine fibroids. Watsi co-founder Grace Gary, who helps produce patient stories on the web, explains she needed $250 for a hysterectomy so she could regain strength to work, potentially start a small business, and raise her family.
We have an update on her now. Her surgery was a success. She's expected to make a complete recovery. And she says, after the surgery, I feel much better, although I have pain on the operating area. I'm excited about recovering and living without abdominal pain and bleeding. I have 6 children. 5 of them don't live with me. In the past months, when they've been coming to visit me, they've always found me in bed. When I recover, they will find me up or even working. I'm sure this will give them joy. Thank you very much for the help you've given me. God bless you abundantly.
Watsi's mission is to provide health care for every person in the world. As the organization works to expand into more countries, that vision moves a step closer to reality. For VOA News, I'm Jan Sluiser in San Francisco.
That's it for this Friday, September 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good weekend.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, a conversation with Arthur Opio Oloya about his book, Black Hawks Rising, the story of AMISOM's successful war against Somali insurgency. That's next, right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.
Let's talk. Money management. Are you good at it? Are you saving for the future? Retirement? College for your children and such? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing money management. Let's talk. Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.